If you say the words red and radio together, most people on the continent of North America, the third word would be Robinson.
Well,
Red is one of three Canadian personalities in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, arguably the most famous. The other is Jay Nelson, and the third is
Dave Marsden.
Dave Marsden.
That's right.
Who is still live online and every Saturday and Sunday night now. And you are still on the radio.
Still on television out here, too. Yeah.
Let's go back to the very beginning, and we won't say what year that was.
Well, it doesn't bother me. I mean, my mom used to say to me, I'd say, Mom, how, you know, what's it like aging? And you know, she says, your health is your age. Isn't that the truth?
Exactly. You started out while you were still in high school.
Yeah.
At CJOR.
Right.
How old were you?
At CJOR, 1953, I would have been 16.
16 years old, and how did you manage to get your foot in the door there? There's an interesting story.
I was a big fan of radio as a kid, and there were two guys that really impressed me. One of them was Jack Cullen here in Vancouver, who had a night show called The Owl Prowl. And unlike, Mike, the announcers that I listened to, who were perfect diction and, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Cullen was, hey, you know what? I'd like to find the temperature out. And he'd take his microphone up on the roof of the place. And it was, in a sense, even with disc jockeys, theater of the mind. Then in Seattle, I used to hear KING. And that was the first block programming I ever heard. I think in Toronto in those days, it was CKEY. Keith Sandy and those guys, I remember that. And there was an afternoon show called King's Open House. And this guy called Gil Henry. And what he did, like the old make-believe ballroom, he created an atmosphere where when he brought the singer on, you thought the singer was in the studio with him. And he had IDs from them, too, and everything. So between Gil Henry and Jack Cullen, I thought, man, if I could just do this, it would be a dream come true. And they were my inspiration. So anyway, one day, they give the answer in the short form. Do we ever give short answers?
No.
Anyway, one day, I'm listening to an afternoon show on CJOR called Theme for Teens, hosted by Al Jordan, one of the best voices this country ever had. He's got this show, and it's an hour long, and I listened to it in the afternoon after King's Open House went off, and he was taking phone calls one day. I had noticed in the Vancouver Sun that Jimmy Stewart, the actor, was in town, and there was a picture of him on the cover of the Sun holding a hunting knife. So I thought, because I was a town clown in school. So I picked up the phone and I phoned Al and I said, oh, hi, Al, this is Jimmy Stewart. And I'm listening to your show. And don't forget to see the Glenn Miller story or whatever. Anyway, he thought that was great. So Jack Wasserman, the columnist for the Vancouver Sun, who would be like Cup in Chicago or Herb Kane in San Francisco, wrote the next day, wasn't that nice of Jimmy Stewart to call the kid show? And I thought, oh my God, I mean, what am I going to do now? So, you know, that was the days when you pay penalties for doing something wrong. And I let the coast clear. And by Friday, because of my ambition and love of radio, I phoned up again. And I said, hello, is this Al Jordan? My old flame. Anyway, I did Peter Lorre. And he said, are you the guy that called in as Jimmy Stewart? And the jig was up. So he invited me down and I became a regular on the show. That's how it started for me.
And then when did you get your own show?
Al had left to go to work, believe it or not, in Penticton. And then from Penticton to Hamilton, Ontario. I went up to visit Al November of 1954. And I go up and visit him. It's the Remembrance Day weekend. I go up by bus and I come back. And I go to school and I get out of school and I go downtown. And Vic Waters, the program director, said, you know, Red, while you're away, you know, this replacement for Al, you've been guesting on the show, but his name was Rod Hume. He said, we've fired Rod, and we don't know if we're going to carry on with the afternoon teen show. But he said the sales manager, Don Law, and myself got together, and we decided that, hey, let's try the kid out on the air and see how he does on his own. So they put me in the control room. I'm a bundle of nerves, and I did an hour show, and when I got off, it's now 5 o'clock. It was 4 o'clock to five. I walk out and there's a whole bunch of people standing out there applauding. And I said, what's this mean, Vic? He said, the show's yours, kid. I said, what was the determining factor? He said, see that switchboard? That's how I started.
Lit up.
Lit up, yeah.
What were you playing then?
Actually, in that day, because I wanted to prove something, I was playing Crazy Man Crazy with Bill Haley and the Comets. I was playing music by the Four Tunes, Marie, which was a doo-wop version of the old Tommy Dorsey hit. And really, R&B leaning.
Was that music in the library, or did you have to go source it yourself?
There were a few in there, but they put them in like what I call cast-asides.
And so the delete bin.
Yes! I would dig them out and play them. And then, of course, I did. I went and bought my own, of course. I couldn't get them. And because in Canada, as you know, the whole market accounted for Chicago in those days in sales, I have to wait out here in the West 2 weeks for something to come out. So I made a deal with a little record company across the border in Bellingham called Stark Music. It was a record outlet. And I would go down there in my car, buy the records and bring them back.
So you got pre-release on just about everything, yeah. And that's how you got...
Well, for the West. Yeah. I mean, you guys had it in Toronto, but I didn't.
Yeah.
So it took a little time. Drove them crazy, I think, for a while, you know.
And how long did that show last?
I did that on my own. It kept growing, Mike, and that's a part of the story that a lot of people don't understand. From that time period, the old radio shows, Jack Benny was going, X-1, from the pages of Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, all those old radio shows were going. Every time one went away, Vic would say, do you want to do that? So at one point there, I was on the air 55 hours a week, and every time they opened it up, I played what I wanted to play.
And you were still going to school at this
time.
Yes,
still going to King Ed, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, King Edward High. And that's how it all expanded. So I guess at CJOR, right up until March of 1957. So it'll be what was left of 54, 55, 56, 57 I left. CKWX offered me a job because they were going to go to 50,000 watts. I went to Vic and I said, here's the money they've offered me. So he went to George Chandler and they said, we're not paying the kid that much money. And so I left. But part of my deal was for every commercial in my show, and I had an afternoon show then and then a night show, 10 o'clock until 1 in the morning. Every commercial ran, they gave me an extra buck. Now, back in 1957, you could pull in that kind of money?
Yeah. That's pretty good for a kid who's in school.
Absolutely.
So I'm sure there was a lot of spending on all kinds of goods that you didn't normally have.
Clothes, cars, and the ladies.
And the ladies. Well, that takes us to the CKWX period. Now, you met some pretty famous people while you were working there at WX.
First of all, as shows would come to town, Bill Haley and the Comets was the first rock and roll concert ever in this city. I was at CJOR at that time, but Jack Cullen and a clothier called Murray Goldman put the money up to put Bill Haley and the Comets on at the Carisdale Arena. Oddly enough, one of the kids in the audience was Bruce Allen. He told me that years later. And said, oh yeah, he said, you emceed that show? I said, yeah. So later on, as acts came to town, they would ask me to go and emcee the show. Simply, I think, because of the following of the rock and roll show.
Well, you were king of the year for the kids.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I guess the crowning moment of all these shows that came to town, I mean, I did the Show of Stars, which was, you know, a traveling show that Irvin Feld, who owned Ringling Brothers, decided rock and roll had some potential. I did those. I did many other shows. But the real moment came in August of 1957 when a promoter out of Seattle called Zolly Volchuk and a local promoter, Hugh Pickett, they worked together, said, Red, Colonel Parker wants you to bring on Elvis at Empire. And how did that come up? They didn't know how it came about, but I did, because I had written in 1956 to the Colonel and said, and I've still got the letter somewhere around there, could you bring Elvis to Vancouver? And he wrote back saying, if we're on a tour in the northwest part of the U.S., we'll put Vancouver on the map. As it was, Zolly booked it in, and I even have the contract that it says, Red Robinson will MC Elvis. I mean, it's amazing. And he was a terrific guy, Mike. He really was.
And you became one heck of an Elvis fan. I think you had every record that he ever made.
Yes.
And I see many dozens of pictures of Elvis and album covers and all the rest of that. That must have been one of the highlights of your career.
Yeah, it was.
But there were many, many others. When you left WX, what year would that be?
In January of 1959, well, actually in late December of 58, I had a phone call one day, as did the morning guy, Bill Davis. Dorothy Bullitt, who owned King Broadcasting, and that was King in Seattle, K-R-E-M in Spokane, KGW in Portland, KSFO San Francisco, she owned a chain, and she made her money when her husband, who had been a logging baron, passed on. But But she was a smart lady, and she went off and bought K-I-N-G, King, off of a freighter in the Pacific. Very smart woman. She's the only woman prior to Oprah ever listed in the Fortune 500. Mm-hmm. So she had money. Anyway, we went down, and Mrs. Bullitt sat there and said, we need to change our radio station in Portland, Oregon, KGW. And what would it take to get you there? And I said, well, you know, we're sitting in her office in Seattle. I said, Mrs. Bullitt, why would I pack up what I've got in Vancouver? I've got a 51% audience share. The money's good. She said, well, we thought that would happen. What would you want? I said, you know what I really want? The only thing that could move me is if I had my own television show. At that time, Mike, as you know, there was only CBC, and unless you worked there, you couldn't get trained. So I took a gamble. Even with all these ratings and everything, I said, yes, I'll come down and do your afternoon show, but I've got to have a TV show. She gave me Portland Bandstand. And then I used to do interview stuff, but I learned television in 1959. So that's why I headed south. Then I was there a year and a half, got a draft notice from the U.S. Army. Quickly ran over and joined the Oregon National Guard. You could do that. And went to Fort Ord, California. And what's interesting about that, when I got in there, one of my old friends from the Pacific Northwest, Gary Taylor, whose real name was Gary Bruno, was there, and he was a secretary. They wore kind of little blue scarves, part of the cadre, to a colonel there on the base. And he said, you know, I'm working weekends at KMBY, because he'd worked down here in radio. He tried to get me out of the infantry group I was with. You know, can I go to the secretarial? I could type 70 words a minute then, you know. He tried, but he couldn't. But anyway, so when boot camp was over, he said, why don't you come over and sit in with me on KMBY on the weekend? So I did that. And through it, I met a guy called Mark Carroll, a disc jockey called Mark Carroll. Well, we all became friends, and we used to sit there on the weekends when we could, having a drink at the Sandpiper on Cannery Row. I was being ushered out, and Bob, Mark Carroll's real name was Robert W. Morgan. And I said, why don't you, and I'm sitting there, you know, half-corked, I said, why don't you use your real name? You know what I'm saying? Robert Morgan. And it's just funny you asked that, because the other day I found a letter from him saying, Red, I've just moved to Fresno, and then from there he went to KJ. But we corresponded and everything else. So that was kind of a neat thing. And Bobby Bear, the country singer, was in the barrack block next to mine. So it was a great experience. I mean, if you're going to get a base somewhere, make it to Monterey and Carmel, California. That's where
exactly.
Fort Ord is. Yeah.
Beautiful. So then you came back to CKWX.
Yes. There was it's funny how all these things come flowing back into my mind. The head of my battalion, Captain called Aldrich B. Hayes. And we were just sitting around waiting to leave the base. And until the exact moment comes, they won't let you. So here I was over in different barracks that were empty, moving mattresses around. So I said to the sergeant, I said, listen, could you ask the captain if I can get out early? I've had offers to go back. And of course, KGW Radio under the law had to take me back if I wanted to go. But I had two juicy offers. One was from CFUN in Vancouver, and the other CKWX. Well, the WX offer was better. The last time in my life I was ever motivated by money. It was a mistake. Not because WX was bad, but I came back, and they were faltering. They were running a whole bunch of different things. It wasn't the top 40 station I'd left. And I listened across the town, and here was Dave McCormick and Frosty Forrest and these guys with CFUN. And I said, no, this is it. This is where I should be. Would you not believe this? I didn't apply for anything. All of a sudden, Dave McCormick and another DJ on the air called Brian Lord decided to pack up and move to the States, just as I had. And so Doug Gregg, who I knew from the old days of WX when he was sales manager, was the GM over there, calls me over and says, Red, come over and be our program director. And I said, yeah, well, I want to be on the air too. Yep. That was 1962. And I went over there and stayed till 1968.
And you had a fantastic crew of guys working.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. One of the news guys was Cameron Bell, who went on to make Global Vancouver, which was then called BCTV, one of the giants in news in Canada. We were talking about that at lunch today. And he worked there. Frosty Forrest worked there. Al Jordan, who I mentioned, worked there. Myself. And then I brought people in. I brought Terry David Mulligan in. I brought Daryl B in. Terry had worked in Regina, and I brought him out. And Daryl B from CKY in Winnipeg, I brought him in. And it was just, the C-Fun Good Guys was really a great radio station. And you know what I learned from Daryl and other people that came to work for me? There were only two stations in Canada that were the ones that they, that were the ideals that they wanted to work for. Chum Toronto, C-Fun Vancouver in those days. That's a fact.
The other thing that I was going to ask you about at 19, when you were at C-Fun, one of the highlights of your many highlights in your career was 1964.
Right.
When the Beatles came.
Do you remember Beatle time, Beatle temperature?
Beatle this, Beatle
it was
that.
Beatlemania. What had happened there, as program director, I had designated Fred Latrimo to go MC the Beatles show. And I thought, what the heck, I've done Elvis and, you know, a few years ago.
Spread the joy around.
Yeah. No, and I've always been like that. Unfortunately for him, Fred got mononucleosis. He was listening to the whole thing on the radio, which, by the way, they broadcast not the music, but they broadcast the event on two stations in town, live. One was CKWX, the other one was CKNW. Fred is out at University Hospital listening to it. As I get up there and say, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of C-Fun, the Beatles!" And Fred said, I just like ripped my heart out. I said, "Well, there's nothing you could do about it." That was an amazing day with them and being out there with them. Yeah.
Now, that was in the middle of a stint on television for you. You went on CBC for a program called Let's Go.
Yep, Music Hub. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Let's Go! Yeah, it was great. And out of that show came people like appearances by Tommy Chong, who went out with Cheech and Chong. Jimi Hendrix appeared on the show. But they were all local kids. Jimmy was living here for a while. A lot of people don't know that. And, of course, Terry Jacks and Susan Jacks became the Poppy family. And I loved it, Mike. And I tell you what, as a Canadian, as I know you are, I'm proud to be so. But that had to be the greatest because Alex Trebek emceed one of them from Toronto or Winnipeg. But we had all of these shows across the country. One, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We were Monday. And out of it, Anne Murray tells me many times, she had her first national exposure on that. What a wonderful mandate to bring forth talent and expose it. And yeah, those were incredible days in the 60s, yeah.
In 1968, I'm using your bio from your site here as my cheat sheet today. You went back to CJOR, where it all started. This time you weren't the kid DJ, you were the guy running the place.
Yeah, I was the operations manager. Not the manager, but the operations manager. What had happened there is, C-Fun, that I dedicated my life and my family's life to, and I loved it. I still cherish it as probably the best period of time I ever had. Just like you guys, and I read about it, you know, Warren Cosford and everybody, reflecting back on Chum, because it isn't just going into the mist of the past. They truly were wonderful times. There was a new thing all the time, and the energy from Chum and the energy from C-Fun. It's hard to explain to people because radio today is not like that. But it was extra special. And when I reflect back on being at C-Fun, doing the Beatles show, having that cadre of on-air people and great news guys like Jim Nielsen, who became a member of the legislature over here, and others, I do it with fondness. And I don't see that in radio today.
As operations manager at...
What I meant was that the three guys that owned C-Fun at that period were headquartered in the East, in Welland, Ontario. They owned C-How, C-H-O-W. They were three guys, if I can remember their names, Leo Brazies was the accountant, Bob Redmond, who went on to own radio station, and Gordon Burnett, the three of them. They got into a fight, and they sold off C-How, and they sold off C-Fun, took the money, and they split it up, I guess, three ways or whatever. I was crushed. The next thing I knew, a former sales guy who'd been on the air as a country DJ by the name of Ed Ferry took over, and he had this idea that the music now should be, after it was sold, the music now should be the Melancrino Strings, Andre Castellanos, and Red was the Morning Man. He called it the Sound of Music. Now, you'd love this one, Mike. We've all got stories. His friend, well, actually, it was his son-in-law, who was an insurance man. He came in and picked all the music out every day and told me how to present it. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, obviously didn't last very long.
No. I had a mortgage, a wife and three kids, and you do these things not because of integrity or anything else. You do it for survival. One day, I get a phone call. It's Jimmy Patterson, and he says, "Red, could you come up to the dealership tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes, Jimmy, I will." And I went up there, and He said, I just bought CJOR, your old alma mater. I bought it from Mrs. Chandler, who owned it. Her husband, George, had started it. I need to have it cleaned up, and your programming abilities have been recommended to me. I said, okay. Anyway, make a long story short, he hired me. I go over there. The station's $600,000 in debt in those days.
That's a lot of
money. Yeah, a lot of money. We built it up, and Jimmy was very generous with the bonuses if we could reach certain plateaus. But I had to go in there with the most mixed up, eclectic set of programs I'd ever heard. I had Tim Burge on at night doing psychedelia. I had, you know, somebody playing Rosemary Clooney in the daytime. It was all over the map. So I had some ideas, and one of them was that let's mix in. Vic Waters had still been there, the program director. He was doing a country show, and it was doing all right. I said, why don't we mix it with some talk and call it Town and Country? So we did that to begin with, kind of a hybrid just to get out of what we were. And then it became more talk. Jack Wasserman was the key columnist in this city. And Jimmy said, go over and hire Jack and get him on the air. I said, okay. They were on strike at the Vancouver Sun. So I had the picket line walking around making a deal with Wasserman. We brought Jack over. And then Jimmy said, I'm going to get Pat Burns back out here from Montreal. They lost him. We brought Pat in. Jack Wasserman, and it turned it into a talk station. People looked at me and said, hey, he's gone from rock to talk. But I knew it was right. At that time, you had CFUN, which is now back into a rock mode after a little while, and CKLG, and how could you compete with that with another one? So it wasn't going to work. But the talk worked and brought in a hell of a lot of revenue, especially bringing Burns back. Burns was a legend in the town. Hmm. And you know, the money you could get from him and his endorsements was incredible. So it wasn't long before we turned that station around. And you know, one of the most fascinating things is all those men who were a little older, as I was. I was the kid that worked with the same guys I had to come back and boss. But I never believed in bossing anybody. But you know what? They were the most cooperative guys. They couldn't do enough for me. It was almost like they were all my surrogate dads and they were proud of what I did. And I treated them accordingly with great respect. And it worked. It really worked. And so it was a good experience, too. But then Jimmy says to me at his house on Boxing Day, I guess that would be 1970, Red, come into the den. I was up at his house. And he said, I hear that you don't want to program anymore. I said, no, I don't want to be a program director. I said, Jimmy, it's a babysitting job. I get calls at 3:00 in the morning. And one of our famous sports guys is missing. I was telling him that. The sports guy's missing. And I get a call from his wife, Alice, in the morning. I don't know where he is. I go, okay. I have some buddies on the police department. They said, oh, he's on the number 1234 auto court on Kingsway. I said, what happened to the police officer I knew? He said, Red, he's a gambaholic, you know that. And I said, yes. He said, he's driving in his new car along Kingsway listening to Jack Short and the races. He sells his car, goes to the track in a cab and blows it all. And went and got a motel because he couldn't face his family. So I said to Jimmy, That's one example I gave Jim. I really don't want to do that anymore. He said, but why don't you go into sales? I said, sales? I've never sold. He said, are you kidding me? You've been selling yourself since the day you started. And you know what I thought then, Mike? I thought, you know what? This isn't going to hurt me for a year, year and a half. It'll certainly put a lot of coin in my bank account and help my family. So I went and did it for a couple of years. Then I did so well, they wanted to make me sales manager. Don Wall, who was the manager who had come from a CFGM in Montreal, said, Red, I want you to be sales manager. I said, no, I don't. Well, in the corporate structure, if you turn that job down, that was it. You were never going to be promoted. So I took a sales job over at CKLG for 13 months, then went into the ad business. I couldn't stand CKLG at that time. It was a zoo. And the sales manager, I had no respect for. So I went over there. 13 months of that. And then I went to work for an ad agency called Dixon Advertising. Turned out to be an asshole, okay? Anyway.
I'm leaving that in.
It's all right. Oh, I don't care. I'll tell you how weird he was. When I started there, he handed out all new employees a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf. So right away, does this strike a note? Yeah. Strange guy. Very brilliant salesman. Had great ideas, but a little off-center. So what had happened quickly, he decided this was an impeccable guy. Beautiful suits every day. Had a haircut and a trim twice a week. And took the car in to get washed every week. All of a sudden, one day he comes to work. He's wearing a flowered shirt and a medallion, and he's going into show business. Now, at 40 years of age, he's going to become the manager, Mack Truck and the Exhaust Fumes. No, no. Teen Angel teen angel in the Rock and Rebels. And he's gone for a year. He returns. The other guy that worked with me was called Steve Verlach. This is a good story. So Mike calls me and he says, you know, while I was away, Steve was doing this and that and stealing from the company and all that. Then I knew damn well he's going to tell Steve that I was the one doing all that. So I phoned Steve that night and I said, you want to hear what he said? Because I'd gone right after I met with Dixon, went in and wrote down everything, and I called him and I said, this is what he said about you. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going in there when I get off the air tomorrow, because I was also doing the mornings at WX at this point. And I said, I'm going in right after the show and I'm resigning. I'm going to clean up my desk and get the hell out. What are you going to do then? I said, you know what? I'm going to start an ad agency. He said, what? I said, sure. He said, well, can I join you? I said, absolutely. Next morning he shows up, we go out, we go and find a hotel to move. The rest of the entire staff of Dixon quit when we walked out the door. They knew what was happening. The headline in the Vancouver Sun should have read, staff fires boss. But we left and formed Verlach Robinson Advertising. I wanted him to be the president. I already had enough profile, and I believe in that. And the part of our agreement, if Steve was sitting here, would agree. I said, we'll do this together as partners on two conditions. One, we never get greedy. We take a small bonus every year and we leave all the rest as retained earnings. Number two, we don't socialize, you and Valerie and Carol and I, but twice a year for a dinner. And he said, why is that? I said, who knows? May not happen, it may, but I don't want to take the chance that Carol comes to me one day and says, how come Steve and Valerie are driving a Cadillac and we've got a Mercury? I don't want that. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff. So it worked. 15 years at work, Mike, and I still love the guy. We're still partners in experiences and life. Great guy. And we took that up when I sold my shares. We're doing $35 million a year.
One Terrific. Of the big clients that you had in your advertising business was McDonald's.
Yes, and I forgot that part of the story. When all this junk was coming down back up to C-Fund, in 1968, I saw the writing on the wall. It was getting pretty tough with those guys selling us out. So I started an ad agency called Trend. And I had a furniture store here, a chain called Better Value. I had Eagle Ford, a couple of other accounts. So I'd get off the air in the morning and I'd go work the accounts and do remotes and all that stuff. One summer, one of the ladies who did hostessing for us on the weekends at C-Fund said, I wonder if you could find a summer job for my husband. And I said, sure. So he came to me. His name was Rich Simmons. Rich, you know, worked with me there because I was adding accounts all the time. I couldn't handle it all. So he helped me with it. Then a man called George Tidball and his partner, Herb Capozzi, came and said, Herb, they said, we've got the rights to a restaurant chain. And I said, really? And they said, yeah. What we want you to do, and we'll pay you, go down to Seattle and have a look at how it works. So I said, okay. And I went down, I came back, and they said, well, what did you think, Red? And I said, oh, definitely, we'll take the account. What an interesting concept. A limited menu. It was hamburger, cheeseburger, fries, milkshakes. It's like the In-N-Out burgers. They had a limited menu. And there's no telephones in there. There's no jukeboxes. You walk up to the counter, you get yourself your 19-cent hamburger or whatever, and leave. And I thought, oh, that's great. But I said, there's one problem, guys. And they said, what's that, Red? I said, I've never worked for a clown before.
They laughed. Well, you probably have, but you didn't want to say that.
No, and then we opened the first... yeah, I didn't want to say that. You're right. We opened the first McDonald's in Canada on Number 3 Road in Richmond, and the second one on Marine Drive in Vancouver, and the third out in Coquitlam. It was quite an experience. Anyway, one day, this has to be told because it's fascinating to me. They said, we need a fillet of fish coupon, like on light cardboard, and we're going to pass them out in a 5-mile radius of each one of the restaurant. I said, well, okay. Well, can you get this done, Red? Oh, yes, I sure can. Didn't know anything about print, but I knew people in the print business. So I go over, and a man called Dick Smith and his wife, Ev, ran a very small printing company. And I said, can we get this die cut of a fillet of fish sandwich? They said, sure, just a minute. We'll get the printer out here. Would you come out, Frank? And out walks this guy in a printer's apron, you know, that keeps all the ink off you. His name was Frank Palmer. And so in the end, I sold the company to Rich Simmons and Frank Palmer, and it became Palmer Jarvis. Today, it's DDB, the largest ad agency in Canada. Frank is the chairman of the board, about ready to step down. But that's a true story. And that he ended up with McDonald's and had the McDonald's account right up to 10 years ago.
You, in 71, you were back at WX, but you also returned to TV later in that decade. Like, I think it was 79,
yeah.
Back on CBC.
Yep.
Show called Trivia Challenge.
Absolutely. They had an open call for show ideas, and it was posted, and a friend of mine, today he's a friend, he wasn't then, his name was Jan Nablo, N-A-B-L-O, and Jan came with the idea, said, how about doing a show on trivia? Later, I asked him, years later, where did you get that idea? He said, well, there was a place out at UBC, a sports bar, and we'd all sit around and do trivia. So they accepted the idea, and then they needed a trivia host, so they... Ken Gibson, who produced the show, called me over, and I did the trivia challenge. It was incredible. And I said to them, well, Ken wasn't interested, but I said to Jan, you know, look at all the game shows. They've got a game. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. The Newlywed Game's got a board game out. So I went around, Mike, with Jan, three different game companies, including Canada Games in Toronto. And they said, okay, well, we'll put the game up, but give us $50,000. You know, that's how they work. And Jan said, what do you think? I said, well, first of all, we'd have to borrow the $50,000. I don't have it. And secondly, I don't believe in going into something I don't understand. I don't know the game business. But what I said we'll do here, we won't do it, Jan, but let's do something smart. Got a hold of an entertainment lawyer called Ken Dangerfield. And I said, register the name Trivia as applied to a board game in Ottawa, Washington, D.C., and London, England, because I think there's something here. Turn the page. Three guys on the panel of Trivia Challenge, unemployed journalists in Montreal who were on the panel of the show. God bless them. I told this to Peter Zosky one time on camera. They sat down at a kitchen table and came up with a trivia game. They were on the show. They knew how it worked. And they came up with their prototype and everything, and they also... couldn't get anybody interested. But in the end, a company across the line in the States said, yes, we can see the potential of this. So they brought it out. In the meantime, they mortgaged their houses and everything. I give them all credit for that. So they bring it out, but they can't call it Trivia Challenge or Trivia. As applied to a board game, it was ours. So they called it Pursuit and they used Trivial to describe it. And people say, oh, I never read that when one of the major contributors of that original Trivial Pursuit died. They never mentioned the fact that it all originated on that CBC show.
All right, you were still doing the mornings on WX while that was happening, right?
Right.
And then you stayed there until 83 and then did a Cross Canada Oldies show after that.
Yes, Satellite Radio Network. Owned them by Selkirk, and then it became Rogers. Yeah, no, I did that, and it was every Saturday night, and that was a lot of fun, too. While I'm doing that, one of the carriers of that was Sea Isle, and the next thing I know, I get a call from Brad Phillips, and Brad ended up, of course, managing Chum at one time. Brad said to me in Gastown, what do you want? We want you to do mornings. I go, oh, my God, I just got used to not sleeping in. But they made it financially worthwhile. And I got to admit, to hook me when it's to do with radio is not a tough job. They said, Red, you can, this is an interesting thing too. We'll make it so you can broadcast from your house or whatever you want. I said, no, you don't know me. I love the feeling of people around
and
me.
And the buzz.
I like people around me. I would never do that. And so I did it live, which meant driving from Deep Cove in Vancouver all the way to the Steveston Highway cutoff. And that was a challenge during the winter months.
Another big event in your life, and you'd been, as somebody said earlier, one of the people you quoted, you'd been in sales and promotion your whole life from day one, because we all have to self-promote if we want to get ahead in this business.
True, Mike.
You started series at Expo 86, where you were bringing in all kinds of rock and roll acts.
That was an interesting time because Dick Drew, who'd been a radio guy out of Hamilton, Ontario, had me and Fred Davis. We alternated doing a series called Expo 86 Review. Prior to that, I made arrangements with an old friend of mine, Les Vogt. We started a company called Jaguar Enterprises and booked acts in. We were the first concert bookers for rock acts. And Les and I sat there and we said, we got to do something with Expo. So we went to Expo. Mel Cooper was in charge of sales. Mel, who owned CFAX up until a couple of years ago. And he was in charge of sponsorships. And also a man called Paul Merckx, who they'd hired to do the concert thing. So Les and I went with our idea, Legends of Rock and Roll, got the sponsor Labatt, and ran 13 weeks in the summer of 86, and 41 of the greatest acts you could ever think of, Ray Charles, the Everly Brothers, Roy Orbison, and the list goes on and on and on. It was an amazing summer. When it was all over, my wife Carol and my kids, who worked it too, said, wow, it's over. This was the most exciting summer, Dad, we ever had. And it was, for me too. And what was going on there simultaneously with that is my friend Ken Gibson, who'd produced and directed Trivia, supplied me with a camera, a setup behind the stage. So between shows at Expo, I interviewed all 41 of them on video. CBC was going to do a show called Forever Rock and Roll. They never did it. 2 years go by, I say, you're going to do anything with it? No. Year three, Mike, I went to them and said, listen, you're not going to use it. How much do you want for it? So I bought all the rights, all the releases, I own it. And it is, they are historical documents now.
Is there any chance that those are going to come out on a CD, a DVD?
Oh, or? You can count on it, Mike.
Okay.
You call me a promoter.
Knowing the promoter and the sales guy in you, I can see those wheels turning around.
Yes,
inside. Now, you went back to television on KVOS in Bellingham in 1989, and you had Red's Classic Theater.
Yes. That was interesting. It had started out, a man we just lost here a week ago, Robert O. Smith. He and I, out of my house, because my basement was like going into a memorabilia headquarters, we did 64 hours of broadcasting, not live, but we taped it all in the basement there. And we did a mixture of old movies and old television shows. It caught on so well, this little Bellingham station. It caught on so well that they came to me and said, we'd like to do a series of Red's Classic Theater. Do you have any ideas? And I said, yes, I do. I said, I don't like it where the host comes on and says, now let's look at the old movie or the old whatever. And that's it. I would like to do it on location. And they said, give me an idea. I said, okay, let's say we run Strategic Air Command, the Jimmy Stewart movie. Why don't we go down to McCord Air Force Base, do all the wraparounds? So we did that for 12 and a half years. Now, some of the titles of the movies you couldn't do that with. But we try to find a way to make it more interesting. There was a television series done out of town called Border Town. So when we had a Western, we'd go there. That kind of thing. And it caught on like crazy. Yeah, 12 and a half years of that. 12 and a half years.
1993, as we roll ahead in the years, and boy, there are a lot of them, you went to Sea Isle.
Yeah.
6:50, did another morning show.
Exactly. That's when I was, a few moments ago, I mentioned that Brad Phillips came to me and said, do you want to do it live or do you want to record it? And I said, no, I have to do it live. And yes, I went out there and I love radio so much. And I listened to what was going on in town and I said, what are the ingredients that I can bring that others haven't got? A lot of it was, and I have over 2,000 interviews with interesting people. I said, well, we'll cut them down to 30, 40, 50 seconders and we'll run those. We'll run contests. We'll make it an audience involvement show. It's funny. I traded ideas with Robert W. Morgan when he was then at K-Earth in Los Angeles, from KHJ days, and of course, K-Earth. We traded ideas. And my approach and his were almost the same because we were from that generation. And it worked very, very well. Sadly, Sea Isle didn't have enough wattage, and its pattern was mostly just into Vancouver and not into the valley at all, over to Vancouver Island. So we didn't reach the potential I thought it could have reached, but it certainly didn't make any difference to my income. It was there.
And you stayed doing the morning show there at Sea Isle until what year?
2000.
To 2000. And then I think my next entry here, a bunch of awards had come your way by then. You were invested into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1994.
Right.
As I said earlier, one of three Canadians currently
yes.
in there.
And I was there with Dave Marsden, by the way, when we were there together.
Right. Yeah. Dave is a dear old friend of mine.
He's a good guy.
The Canadian Broadcast Hall of Fame, 1997. The Rockabilly Hall of Fame in 2000. I think you have a star on the Walk of Fame.
Yes, BC Entertainment.
You have a bunch of other honors, including the Red Robinson Show Theater
and the
Boulevard Casino. Yeah. You haven't slowed down in the least, and you're still on the radio.
Yeah, I'm on once a week doing a show I call Red Rock Diner, because one of the most flattering things that ever happened to me, Mike, was a playwright by the name of Dean Regan wrote a play about 1 week in my life in radio during the first halcyon days of rock and roll. And he called it Red Rock Diner. That ran at the Arts Club Theater 1 year and then the next. Then it went across Canada. It was in Windsor, played Mississauga, played Kansas City. Carol and I traveled with it. Watching the Tonys last night, the winners were Memphis, Come Fly Away, the Sinatra thing on Broadway, but the Million Dollar Quartet. It seemed to me that it was all musical rock and roll 1950s and up. And that's what Broadway's become. So maybe Red Rock Diner can come back now.
Well, it all seems to be coming back. There's a tremendous interest by young people in the music of the 60s and 70s again. Look at the sales of the Beatles remasters.
Oh.
People are starting to rediscover that music because basically what we're listening to these days is, I call it, awful tuned crap.
Well, you know what happened? I think what happened was the development of things like this computer here and all of these things where you could, you could experiment. A guy showed me one day over at one of the sound studios in town. He said, "Can you sing?" And I can't sing a note. He said, "Well, here, I want you to do this." After about half an hour, I put out in a certain tones that he called for, and I came out like I was singing.
He tuned it.
Yeah.
With auto-tune.
But I think all of that gimmickry.
But that's what most people rely on today. We're not going to be hearing those in 20 years.
No.
We're still going to be hearing the classics from the 40s and 50s and 60s, but we're not going to be hearing the current day crap.
You know why they call it rap? Every performer of rap has a rap sheet.
Vancouver Music Industry Award, the Bruce Allen Sam Feldman Legend Award for his support of the local music industry, which you've been involved in since
day one.
Day one.
Yeah.
And you also have been honored by the Royal British Columbia Museum as one of 132 influential British Columbians.
Yeah, you know, you don't go out to win these things. And what you've just read here, and you and I have talked for the last half hour, these awards, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Canadian Broadcast Hall of Fame, and a lot of people don't believe it, I guess, if they're on the outside, but they were all a surprise to me. I have an Irish background, and my old Irish grandfather used to say to me when I was a teenager, he said, "You know what, son, whatever you do in life, remember this, honor seeks the man does not seek the honor." Not once in my life have I ever gone out to seek anything. And you know what? That makes all of these things extra special.
And I think you can say, as I do, I've never worked a day in my life.
No!
It's all been fun.
The only part I will now add, at this age and stage of my life, is I couldn't believe they paid me.
And you have been extremely generous with your very large collection of memorabilia. You are packaging things up as we sit here to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as part of a much larger exhibit honoring you and other Canadians who made a huge contribution to this business.
Absolutely. And of course, I might say to all of our friends in Toronto, Duff Roman and all the guys, that all the radio stuff I'm saving for them. And our museum that's going to happen. It has to happen. I can't believe we're the only country in the G20 that hasn't got a broadcast museum. We do not.
Well, they're working on that in Toronto as we speak.
Exactly.
And you're a part of that
I'm
as well as I am. And a lot of us are getting together to try and make it happen before the corporations throw out all of the history. I like to finish these off by asking two questions.
Surely.
Favorite moment in your career? What was the big moment for Red Robins?
I'm a kid. I'm 20 years of age. I'm standing on the stage at Empire Stadium. There's an audience outside of 20, across the stadium, 26,000 people. I'm shaking in my boots, and I get up to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, here is the man you came to see tonight, Elvis Presley." That was the most unbelievable thing. Not because it was Elvis. Later I realized how important that was, but it was standing up in front of 26,000. You can understand something, Mike. I tell people, listen, they scratch their head. Before Elvis Presley, no one, not Bing Crosby, Sinatra, no one rented stadiums to put on shows.
No, they were all in clubs.
That's great.
400 people max,
and
perhaps.
Or theaters.
Theaters, yeah. No more than 400 to 500 people at a time.
No.
And the second question. Favorite people, both in radio and showbiz, that you've met and talked
with? Well, one of the guys I was in the Army with, I mentioned, Robert W. Morgan, a great guy. Gary Taylor, who ended up, by the way, I forgot to mention that, when he was in the Army there, he's from just across the border in Anacortes. When I met him at Fort Ord, he went on to replace Bill Gavin with the Gavin Report. He's another one of my favorite people. There's so many. In show business, one of the greatest gentlemen I ever met was Nat King Cole. Elvis was like a school buddy that I'd gone to school with. Buddy Holly, when I met him, it was like two old school chums. I've been a very lucky man. I've had an incredible journey. But those people make it for you, don't they?
They sure do.
And Vic Waters, who had faith in me, the program director at CJOR, taking a chance on a rube, a kid with no experience. Who could forget that moment? That's got to be the magic moment of all when I think about it. Bringing on Elvis and bringing on the Beatles was incredible. But that first show I ever did, that has to be the benchmark. That has to be the most important thrill. To walk out and hear that the radio show is yours.
And one more, because sure. of your vast experience, you and I have been in the business for over half a century, pretty much.
100 years between
100
us?
100 years between us. I want to say, if somebody came up to you and gave you a radio station today that had no debt and said, Red, here's a radio station, what would you do with it?
Well, the first thing I would do, Mike, is I would find enough money to hire the best people. There's so much talent. There's more talent at our little get-togethers out here once or twice a year, sitting in the room, than all of the radio stations combined in the city. Yes, I would hire the talent. I would market it and promote it. And the format really would be secondary as long as it was entertaining and informative. The one thing Pat O'Day, who's a good friend of mine in Seattle, we both say to each other, where in hell is the news component on a music radio? Like you're saying, all those people don't want news? They don't want information? No, and that's another thing I do. I put that ingredient in there. Why would I tell people to tune away from me for 5 or 10 minutes? It's wrong. Put entertainment and information together. What a breakthrough!
Didn't we do that back in the 60s?
Exactly.
Red Robinson, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mike.